if you do let your students float along, progressing really slow, in a lot of ways, you're doing them a disservice. Because when you sell the service of teaching piano, your student should finish their lessons and know how to play the piano. And I know a lot
well,
of people...
Well, yeah. Welcome to the Piano Sensei Way. I am your host, Clinton Pratt, and I am here to help you master the art of running a successful piano teaching studio. Today, we're going to talk with Jake McHugh, and I'll have him introduce himself, but I just want to tell everybody that I'm super excited because I haven't met him before, but I was having a discussion with him in a Facebook thread, and I thought, oh, wow, he has really cool ideas and thinks like me, because, of course, this is the Piano Sensei Way, which means, like, my way is the best way. So, not to be egotistical, but, you know, it's just kind of our ongoing joke or whatever that, you know, this is the Piano Sensei Way, so this is how I do things, and if you want to be successful like me, do it my way, right? So it's just kind of like tongue-in-cheek or whatever. But Jake had some similar things that I think about things. But, you know, I may play devil's advocate too. And, you know, just to challenge different ways of thinking or whatever. All right, so I would like to welcome Jake. Tell us where you are and what you do or teach.
Hi, I'm Jake. I teach mainly piano and bass. I actually have a studio called Pinnacle Music House out in Richmond, Virginia. And so it's just me and one other teacher. I do most of the teaching, and then he teaches kind of a few lessons on the side, and hopefully he'll grow as well. So just a little piano studio out in Richmond, Virginia.
Okay, great. And how long have you been teaching?
So I got my first student, let's see, in December of 2022, I think. So not a super long time. I did have a few students off and on during college, you know, sometimes between summer break or something like that. But really what happened was I was working a sales job and I thought, I could probably do this for myself and have a pretty good time. So then I started trying to find clients, and I actually still have my first student, which makes me happy. So.
Okay. Yeah, that's fun. Yeah, so you haven't been teaching terribly long. I've been teaching probably 23, 24 years. And I know some teachers, you know, even in this Facebook discussion or whatever, we won't mention any names, but some people, you know, think it's a downfall or something, like, well, you've only been teaching 1 year, so what do you know, with your ideas or whatever. But, you know, just because you're young or don't have that much experience yet, that doesn't mean that you can't think about how to teach and want to teach better and have good ideas. And right. I mean, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think experience, if you're qualified, is great. You know, so if you've been teaching for 20 years and you're doing a great job, then awesome. But I think a caution or a danger with piano teaching in general, in my opinion, over music education in general, is there's a lot of lack of quality control. And so before I started teaching myself, I applied to a few similar businesses to what I'm doing. Actually, I applied to Guitar Center to teach, and they didn't even require a audition to do it. And so You just think about that all over the country, anybody could theoretically say they're a piano teacher or a music teacher in general. And I question a lot of the ways that I see some of things being taught in music education. I can't think of specifics now, but I remember hearing people in college speaking about their music ed degree and thinking, that sounds a little too idealistic. You know, so I've kind of been trying to do it my own way, and I do study things and try to learn, but I take caution just taking everything at its face value too.
Yeah. I have a funny story too. When I first started teaching, and I actually joined the board, I was on the executive committee for the local music teachers association, And I was like, oh, wow, I felt honored to be on it. But really, you know, it was like they were having trouble getting volunteers to be on the board. So I was on the board. I was young, press teacher, whatever. And I had all these ideas, like I was questioning everything because, you know, I just started. So I was bringing up all these things and questioning, like, well, why do you do it that way? You know, and some people would get a little bit offended, like, well, we've done this way for this many years. However, pleasantly surprised because they kept voting me to stay on the board. So I think they appreciated, you know, the sort of like the fresh ideas and just like having somebody younger, I don't know, maybe inexperienced, not necessarily bad because you're just like, you're learning things and eager and whatever. But anyway.
Yeah. And that was something that the people commented online too. They'd say, well, you know, you've only been doing this for so long. What do you know? You shouldn't even try. Go find someone to help you. And I actually do take lessons, but one other thought I have is and maybe you could correct me on this, but I think most piano or private teachers don't have that many students anyway. And so when I was growing up, I had a private piano teacher. She passed away actually, but I don't think she must have had more than 10 students. And so she had been teaching for decades, but if she was only teaching 5 to 10 students, that's a completely different experience and rate of growth as a teacher than it is teaching 20, 30 something students a week, back to back to back, you know, running into things. Cause when I started, I was definitely fumbling a lot and I probably still do, but I was able to quickly fix those mistakes because I would be reinforced in my way throughout the day. So I screw up with one student and they go, well, that was wrong. Or maybe I blamed it on the student for that lesson. But after three more, then I went, oh, okay, maybe I can fix something.
Right. Yeah. I'm curious what the stats are on like average number of students. I don't know. Cause when I started teaching, I mean, I probably had 30 or 40 students a week. I know a lot of teachers that even have more than that, like 60. But there's probably a lot of part-timers too. And, you know, I have no idea. So, yeah. So let's get into sort of basically, I wanted to talk with you about setting standards and expectations for students and tracking progress, because that was the post that you did in the group that got all this discussion. Why is this something that you're thinking about? Or, you know, what do you think about imposing minimum expectations for students?
Yeah. So partially, I don't know. That's why I put the post on there.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people made assumptions that I was planning on implementing that tomorrow to my students that I've had. And I didn't necessarily, I mean, I lean one way and I'll get into that in a second, but I didn't necessarily have an opinion either way. I was just kind of trying to see what other people have done. The reason this came up is there's a school, I might've even sent them to you. There's a school out in Australia called Muso Music Academy, and they have had a really positive effect on my teaching, just watching some of their videos and helping me. And I believe, if I understand their teaching correctly, they do impose a minimum. And the way they do it is they're pretty ambitious with their students. But I believe they impose a minimum of 2 ABRSM grades a year, I think. And wow. I don't know if that's a good standard or a bad standard or anything, but their students are very successful and they, in the videos, seem to enjoy playing quite a lot. And so, you know, I think in one sense, when you're a piano teacher, if you do let your students float along, progressing really slow, in a lot of ways, you're doing them a disservice. Because when you sell the service of teaching piano, your students should finish their lessons and know how to play the piano. And I know a lot
well,
of people,
yeah.
A lot of people take lessons and then can't really play even after a long time. And I think a lot is, I don't know if too nice is the right words, but teachers that are so relaxed to a fault, too relaxed to a fault, where, you know, a student will take a year and a half to go through a Faber-Primer book or something. And then, well, that's okay. You know, you don't need a push. We'll just keep you at your own pace because we don't want you to get upset.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally think that the teachers that I've had growing up that stand out to me are the ones that push me to be my best, that pushed me beyond where I thought I was able to be as a musician or as a person. And so thinking that through with minimums was something I thought, well, maybe the opportunity of failure would inspire people to take it seriously.
Yeah, I think this is a big topic. And you know, there's different kind of teachers and different kind of studios. And so, you know, even though I joke with like, oh, the piano sensei way and do it my way, whatever, you know, there are different ways of doing it. So yeah, I think some teachers, maybe they think of themselves as more like, what do you call it? I don't know, like a recreational music or something. But yeah, what you're bringing up is, you know, what kind of standard do we want or expectation? Because like you said, if you're taking piano lessons, you should be able to play the piano, right? So hopefully, like, that's what the students want. That's what the parents want, right? So how, like, what kind of things could we measure, or how would we have these expectations? Like, play a certain number of pieces, or, you know, practice this much amount of time? What do you think?
Yeah, I don't think measuring practice is effective because students, I'm sure you've experienced it, students will tell you they practiced. Sometimes parents will tell you their kids practiced, and maybe they were right, but a lot of times you question their truthfulness about it. You know, you're like, okay, you said you practice an hour every day, but you're worse than you were last week somehow. So
Right.
don't. Last week you could play five songs, and this week you could play three. So I don't know how that's possible. All jokes aside, though, I think having some sort of objective measuring system in place where students know where they are would be helpful. And that's what you and I got into conversation with privately about. And it sounds like there's some parallels in your piano sensei teaching and what I've been kind of putting together. And all what we were kind of talking about is basing it on, you know, those standardized piano examinations that they have all over the world that people have taken time to think about what skills are required for each piano level and have put them on a syllabus. And, you know, when you take the exam, they have a little board of people that tell you whether or not you are capable of doing those things. And so I thought, okay, well, that's in a standard across the world. Whereas a lot of times people say they're level one in Faber, but level one in Faber is completely different to John Thompson or Alfred or anything. So having something more international, something more solid, I think would be good.
Right. Yeah, and when I learned about the RCM program, Royal Conservatory of Music, based in Toronto, I was like, wow, I never had anything like this when I was taking lessons. And you know, a lot of the Canadians who were telling me about it, they said, oh yeah, this is just normal. Like anybody who takes music lessons, it's just a given that like you know what level you are. They say grade, but you know, like, oh, I play piano. Oh, really? What grade are you? Oh, I'm grade four. Like they're grade four piano, or they're grade eight. And it's just universal pretty much in Canada. Like if you take lessons, that's the level you are. Just like, oh, I'm in school. Oh, really? What grade are you in? Oh, I'm in ninth grade. Right? Like, it just seems normal. And I was always like, oh, wow, that's cool. I never had that when I was growing up taking lessons. I was just like, well, I don't know. I can play this piece and I can play Linus and Lucy and kind of a sonatina and I can improvise a little bit, you know, like, but how do I compare to others? And like, is this where I should be if I'm gonna major in music and all this, right? Like, I didn't have that plan, but it would just been nice to like have some kind of leveling system or standard. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And even within a studio, I don't have a physical location at the moment, but if you do and you're trying to get people to become friends, having that as knowledge, or even, you know, if you were to give them wristbands or something where they could see what level they are, might not only motivate them, but also allow them to help each other, you know, something like that. Same for me. And actually, well, bass, so my main instrument is double bass, or it was until about this year. So that's my double bass back there. And the only reason I mainly teach piano now is because I could play piano well enough to get people started when I started. And I thought, well, it'll take a while before they're so good that they can't take lessons with me anymore. And I honestly thought there's probably not that many people that want to learn double bass in Richmond, Virginia. So I said, well, everyone wants to learn piano. I'll push both. And of course, there's way more piano interest than double bass interest. So with that though, double bass, they do have levels too, actually. RCM has them, but I never did that either. I just had one teacher, and she was that teacher that started pushing me at first. And one of the things I like about the levels that's different from regular piano teachers is it allows the teacher to know when you're ready for certain real classical works. And for me, I had a hard time staying motivated going through easy songs when I took regular piano lessons. It seemed like there was an endless mountain of these. I can't even remember what method my teacher had me in, but whatever method I was in, it seemed like they would never end. It was just more method books. And when I started working with my bass teacher, she put me in like two method books. We finished them in 3 months, and then she started handing me real music. And it opened up my entire life to, I always kind of wanted to do music, but it gave me a path forward where I was like, oh, I'm actually doing real music now. It's not something that sounds childlike. And it really inspired me. And so I have a few students that are like that. They don't really like playing. I think the method books are helpful and I will still use them, but they want to do something more than that, you know? So that's been something helpful about them too. When I was in college, what's funny about the RCM method is they gave me a book in Ear Training 101 or something, Theory 101. And I didn't recognize the book, I didn't think about it, but we went through it. It was the year one ear training book. So I made it all the way into Shenandoah Conservatory, and then they hand me a year one theory book. And I thought, well, that's when I realized that learning about RCM, I thought, well, that's not good. You shouldn't be able to go to college and they assume that you can't do a year one book.
That's interesting. And I know some college auditions, like, they don't even have you sight read. If they did, I probably wouldn't have gotten in because I was a horrible sight reader. It would take me forever to learn a piece, but I did, I would learn pieces and pieces hard enough and advanced enough to play well and play an amazing audition. And then, like, reality hit when, I go to my first lesson, I'm like, okay, here's your new piece, play it for me next week. And I'm like, oh my gosh, there's no way I can read that. Like, it was horrible. I didn't have any sight reading skills, really. And I know the RCM and some of the others, they have sight reading as part of the one of the components of the exam, right? I mean, you could still totally bomb the sight reading and pass the exam, but if you want to do well, you would work on that as well.
And my school did have some sort of requirements. I don't remember them. I remember they gave me another piece of music that I had to sight read in the audition, and I have to imagine I totally bombed it, because for all intents and purposes, I was basically rhythmically illiterate for the first year of college. And after that, started figuring out, I think actually the biggest trick for me was just being able to visually or even physically draw in lines between the beats and see how it all broke apart. When I figured that out, it was, and figuring out how to count out loud with a steady beat and all those things, it was very helpful to just be able to do it. But before then, if I saw anything other than quarter notes, half notes, or whole notes, and it was in a sight reading thing, it was gonna be really rough. So I understand your pain there. One interesting thing about the requirements, I say this respectfully, but there was only two people that commented that they do impose requirements on them, on their students. And also the school in Australia I told you about, Muso, is similar to that. And they're all culturally Asian. So I talked to one of the guys in the comments, and we talked for a while. I can't remember his name, and I probably shouldn't bring it up anyway, but he imposed minimum expectations. And the studio out in Australia is, I believe the owners of it come from Hong Kong. And so they're very modern in their way of teaching. They make it fun, but that was something I noticed. And I wonder if it's a different way of thinking compared to more of the Western model we have here right now that's going on.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, we have the benchmark program at my studio. And like my studio is kind of Japanese themed. So, however, it's not actually required at this time that everybody who joins my studio participate in that. But most people do it because they see the other ones do it. And we have like the big board in the lobby that shows everybody's names. And so it's like, okay, well, either their name isn't up there or they're just like stuck in the white and like not moving across. And so they're like, how do I move across? Like, oh, well, you got to do this, you know? So kind of like indirectly motivate students to do it, but don't actually make it a requirement. Like if you join our studio, you have to do the benchmark program. We get a lot of different kinds of students and adults. A lot of adults actually do it, but some just have a specific goal, you know, like I want to learn to play lead sheets and Christmas tunes so next year I can play for my family or something. So it's like, okay, well then why am I going to make you memorize 5 classical pieces? I mean, that's just not aligned with their goals, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I have similar students and I don't even have my program that I'm working on imposed on anyone yet, but yeah, I have one student actually, and her only goal is to be able to play a instrumental version of Layla, the old classic rock song, on the piano. That's all she wants to do. And I had to fight with her. I wouldn't say fight, but I had to strategically convince her that she really needed to increase her technique abilities, because the version she chose is pretty challenging for a beginner. And there would be no reason, and I actually think it would insult her in one sense, to give her a program that looks kind of childish to an adult. So we just kind of let her do her song, and we're working through that Layla one measure at a time.
Yeah, well, and that's, you bring up a good point, because that happens often with me too, or in my studio, where a student, especially an adult, has the specific goal, you know, like I want to play this piece. It's like Claire de Lune or you know, something. But it actually, if that's their goal and you know that they need some more technique and they need blah, 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 it's a good way to like impose, not impose, but, you know, like have them practice and work on skills so that it will lead to their goal, but it will also help them with other things, right? Like if they need to work on their technique. So in other words, oh, you want to play Layla? Well, you're going to be able to have to do this. So we need to work on your rhythm, and this would help you with your rhythm. Let me give you a little etude or an exercise, right? I think that's important to know, that even if there is one specific goal that seems, I don't know, narrow or whatever, as a teacher, we can use that opportunity to sneak in the other skills, because they actually need those other skills too for that, right?
Yeah, you actually just gave me an idea with her, because I don't know if I've always done the best job explaining why she would need to do certain things. I might. She seems content with the lessons. But yeah, sometimes, you know, I'm working on having her count out loud right now. And that's something that she's, I would say, not excited about. And maybe I could do a better job explaining to her why we're doing that. And we did write it in, actually, in Layla for part of it. That was kind of fun. But yeah, and then the other thing is, yeah, at first when I started teaching, I wanted to be the teacher that could help everybody. But lately I've been wondering, well, maybe I need to build these curriculums out for one genre or one goal at a time, and kind of stop taking students that have different goals until I have them. So all I mean by that is not that I don't want to help those students, but maybe start with a classical curriculum because it's pretty standard, and then build out a jazz curriculum. And then pop, songwriting, all of them, but they actually have steps and they're methodical, and they're not just me scrapping things together because the student wanted to learn something that I haven't really figured out myself yet, and, you know, that kind of thing.
Do you want to connect with other teachers in person? Do you want to learn new teaching strategies and explore outside-the-box approaches? Join us at the Creative Teaching Conference, a radical retreat to recharge and reinvigorate your teaching. This unique conference was started by me and my two friends and colleagues, Christopher Oyle and Tony Parlapiano, back in the summer of 2022. All three of us had so many ideas we wanted to share, but instead of trying to get selected for an MTNA or NCKP conference, we created our own event. We each present a few workshops, but we also have guest presenters as well. Topics include improvisation, composition, student-led learning. You'll experience inspiring workshops on creative teaching strategies and creative performance ideas. Learn about different ways to structure lessons, such as online groups, memberships, and subscription models. We eat meals together and plan social time so you can connect with teachers from all over the country, forming new musical friendships that will last a lifetime. Mark your calendars for July 7 to 9, 2024 in Cincinnati, Ohio. Check out creativeteachingconference.com for more info.
Another point or question is fun versus progress. So I know, like, in the Facebook discussion, some of the teachers were saying, oh, well, you know, my students just want to have fun, so I'm not going to have expectations or requirements. I think you said, like, well, people have fun and enjoy things that they're good at, right? So, like, I know for me, like, I hated baseball when I was a kid. If we have to play it for gym, or like the neighbor kids were going to play, I'm like, no, it was awful. But when I think back, it's because I was really bad at it. I don't, right? It's like, why would I? That's not fun. It's not fun at all. So talk about that for a second, you know, like fun versus, I don't know, working hard or progress.
Similar to the education majors, and different ways I can get idealistic about things. So when I started teaching, I don't have a big family. I don't have a lot of siblings or anything like that. So when I started, I had a very idealistic idea of what a five-year-old was able to do. And it didn't help, because my first student, still to this day, is by far one of my hardest working students. So she just turned 7 like a week ago. I started her when she was 5, and she's practiced at times for 2 hours a day, which is unheard of basically for any of my other students. And she's progressing so quickly, it's amazing. So I started with that preconceived idea about how they should progress, and then had a student that's kind of an out of the ordinary student that affirmed that. So I can kind of lean towards that direction if I'm not careful, where I'm like, well, maybe you shouldn't have fun. You should just suffer while you're doing this. And I've had to fix that over time, because when I started, I didn't really play any games or anything. And now my lessons are totally, everything's silly. I push them pretty hard, but I try to make everything kind of into a game or something. So I'll bring stuffed animals to the lessons. I bring a drum to the lessons. I actually have a bell. Actually, I have one of them right here. That'll hit when they hit the answer correctly. It's just a regular hotel bell.
Mm-hmm.
And I literally, in my free time, just think, what would have made my day when I was 5? And the things that would have made my day when I was 5 were never really that big. It was like getting to hit this bell when I go to the store. That would have made my day, or whatever. And so I just find, with the stuffed animals I bring, I'll change them out without telling the students, and then I'll pretend that I didn't do it. So all these things to say that I focus a lot on trying to make it fun, but I don't make it fun at expense of the education. So all these things that I also add to the lessons have purposes in what I'm doing. So why do I have a bell? Well, when they get the answer correct, I want positive reinforcement. So I have that. And I just got a red buzzer that makes a wrong sound for the same purpose. So when they get it wrong, that happens. Yeah, so that's some of the things I do. Or with the stuffed animals, I use them as lives, So if you make a mistake, I'm just going to throw it and you're going to lose a life. And if you lose all 3, then you're going to start over. Just whatever I can do to make it fun, because I want them to get in those repetitions. So another thing that we do, because a lot of these things that you have to do, the hard part doesn't have to be suffering. And as an adult, I don't know about you, Clinton, but I really actually enjoy practicing. I think part of it is when you have a good expectation of what practice is, it helps. So when you're an adult, you know that you're going to fumble on it 35 times before you can play it correctly, and then you're still going to screw up. But when you know that going into it, it's kind of relaxing to practice. If you think you're going to play it correctly from the start, it's frustrating. And so one of the ways I get them to do repetitions is I'll start them slower. And I realize if you have them just do it over and over again slow, they'll hate you. But sometimes you kind of have to do that. And so there's a balance. I mean, I guess you wouldn't have to, but you have to do something like that to demonstrate how to practice something or how to progress through something. You have to get them to do it. So I figured out if you just make it faster every time and you make it into a game and you hit the bell, it's like all of a sudden the most addicting video game they've ever played in their life. And I should clarify, most of my students are between like 5 and 10. So I'm not teaching a lot of older people. But those kinds of things. So all that's about what I do to make my lessons fun. You were talking about making the lessons fun just generically. I wonder how much fun most kids actually have in their piano lessons. Because like I said, going back to the method book thing, if you give them a method book and you just go through it page by page, which I do partially, so I'm not trying to tear that down completely, but if you just no creativity, just going through the method book and you're not doing anything other than reading the book to them, that's not going to be fun, even if you don't have expectations. For me, I don't know if fun is always the outcome, and I think it is okay to have moments while you're learning something that are not fun. And so I say that cautiously. I don't mean that you should be cruel to your students or make them upset, but you know, when you're having to learn something, it can be frustrating sometimes. And I think it's probably positive that kids understand that and mature through that. We can't sugarcoat everything, because if they don't learn that here, they might have to learn that at their job later or in school. So to me, I'm okay with that discomfort from time to time, you know?
Yeah. And the whole thing with fun, like some people might think fun just means, I don't know, not working at it or something. But I mean, think about games. Like we think, oh, you know, let's play a game. A game is fun. And you're, oh, you just play games. You don't learn piano, you know. But if you really think about what a game is, and like a good game is that it's challenging. Like it's the right amount of challenge, right? If it's too easy, like here, we're going to play this card game. As soon as you flip up a card, you win. Like, who wants to play that game? That's too easy, even though you win.
Yeah.
Right? But or the other, you know, if it's too hard, like here, you flip up a card, you have to flip up 6 random cards in a row, and like they all have to be a 5. Well, that's impossible, right? So like a fun game, I love board games and everything, and like my favorite ones are, when I think about it, they're challenging, like they're kind of hard, but not too hard, right? And so it's like, so you want to play it again because you want to like beat it. And so I think that's also kind of what you're getting at, is it is fun to work at something and try to get, you know, or I want to get you to ding the bell for me. So I want to work hard to get it, right? Or like, oh, I have to play this slow because the game is to play it 3 times in a row correct, no matter what the speed is. So, okay, well, I'm just going to go slow and be very disciplined and focused, right?
Yeah, I think, too, when your student does get it right, it's really important, especially if you're teaching a child, that you risk over-rewarding them. You know, like, when my student gets it right, I'm hitting a bell. I'm going to be like, that was amazing. I'm giving them a high five. Because, one, I wonder if sometimes kids are not only not rewarded for good things they're doing, but are also maybe even punished, you know, depending on their home life or school or whatever. And I think as piano teachers, especially in a private lesson setting, you have an opportunity to build a really good mentorship relationship with that child, where you can support them while they're trying to better themselves. A lot of my students, not at first, but especially within the last few months, I've kind of developed really close relationships with them, just, you know, in a professional way. But a lot of that, I think, is because when you're genuinely rooting for them and you're checking on them to see they're practicing and all this, and you show that you want them to succeed and you celebrate with them, that's fun. I wonder, a lot of times people now think fun is something like euphoria without challenge all the time. I think is what most people think fun should be, which would get boring after a while. So,
right.
The most fun is when you don't think you can do something and you've been trying and trying and trying, and then you succeed in a big way that you never thought was possible.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I know there are a lot of, well, I get a lot of prospective students at my studio, and the parent says, you know, oh, well, you know, we just want them to have fun. And a lot of that is like decoding what they actually mean. Because like you said, I don't think they actually mean we don't want them to learn anything, like, right? I mean, they just mean, well, I don't know. What do they mean? They mean we don't want it too strict, or like where they have to do some competition they don't want to do. Like, I guess that's what they mean when they say we just want to have fun, right? I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, that's a good question. I found the students I've had, and maybe that I need to change some of my marketing because I do talk about having fun in my lessons on my website and things, but the students I've had that were too worried about fun usually didn't do too well. Or, I mean, it's usually from the parent, right? Like, the kid isn't really know whether or not it's going to be fun, so they're not worried if it's going to be. And yeah, there is something like, what do you mean exactly by that? Because if you just mean that they can goof off for half an hour and bang on the keys, well, that's different than them actually learning. And my point in that thread was, there are places to do that already, and maybe there should be a different place. Maybe there should be a place where if you don't want that your kid to do that, you can come here. I guess for me too, I don't depend my decisions. I don't base my decisions on the opinions of kids all the time. So sometimes I do, if they start crying in a lesson, I'm gonna think really hard about that, about what on earth just happened that made this happen. But I do think we sometimes overweigh kids' opinions about things because kids are kids and they can be really smart and they can figure things out, but they're also five and that's okay. But my viewpoint on that is, my parents were very casual and kind of liberal with what extracurricular activities I could do. If I wanted to do soccer, which I did do, I could suck and do soccer, and that was great. If I wanted to do swimming, I could do that. If I wanted to do football, actually, they wouldn't let me play football. That was the only thing I wasn't allowed to do, but I could do anything else. So with that, I don't know if I agree with that because, and maybe you can agree with this or disagree, but when I play shows, the most common thing adults will say is, I used to play when I was five and I quit, and it's the biggest regret I ever made. Pretty much every time I've played a show, I hear something like that afterwards. And so part of being an adult, a mature adult, is knowing what's best for them long term. And I think that goes to, if you think it would be valuable for your kid to learn an instrument, there is an aspect of making them. And when you do that, it's your job to make it not torture, but you can sign them up for things and require them because we do that already. And I don't personally see a convincing argument that English class is less or more important than music class. I think they're equally important for different reasons. And I would say the same for sports, even though I'm very out of shape, because these are parts of life that people need to understand and have exposure to, and even have, to some degree, some competence in to be well educated.
Yeah, so I've had this experience where we have like studio events where they can sign up to do like a adjudicated event or a festival or play in a recital, you know, all this stuff. And sometimes a parent will respond to me, oh no, they don't want to do it. We're not going to do it. You know, and this is like for like a 6-year-old. Yeah. And I'm thinking like you, I'm like, well, of course they don't want to do it. Like if you just ask them, like it's, I don't know, like it's just an open-ended choice or like it's a chore or something like, hey, do you want to go do this thing? You know, like, no, that, why are you letting them, the 6-year-old, say they want to or not want to? Like, here, this is what we're doing, right? And so, like, I'm trying to get the parents to sign them up to sign the kids up to do stuff. And some of the parents ask the kid, like, do you want to do this? You know, and so I'm trying to, like, diplomatically and politely tell the parent, like, no, just sign them up.
Yeah. Well, and what's worse is, are they saying that or are they phrasing it a way that they're not excited about it? Do you want to do this really hard piano competition? This kid's like, no, I want to watch TV, which is what I would say, and I think too, one of the reasons kids feel like practice is a chore, and this took me a while to figure out, is they make the kid go by themselves into the other room and practice with a timer. I'd say that's default parent position on practice is, my teacher says you need to practice every day, so you need to, by yourself, you 5-year-old, go in that room away from me so I can make my coffee and practice the piano. And that's not effective. Unless, in very rare situations, is that effective. And now I completely put the practice on the parents. And I'll say, you need to work with your child on this. And when the kid doesn't practice, I'm like, you need to ask your mom for help. I don't say, you need to practice because they're six or nine even, and then when I talk to the parents, I show them what we worked on and teach them how to make it fun at home. And I've seen that really open some doors, because when it becomes a quality time between you and your parent that you love, hopefully, you know, then it's cool. But when you just send them away like it's another chore, then yeah, it is challenging to want to do those competitions and those things. And I agree, you should just sign your kids up. For me, I learned that sometimes you do things that you don't feel like doing, so later you're happy you did them, you know? And I think if you're a parent, you have to know that about your kids. If they don't want to do the competition, well, okay, but what if they win? Because if they win that competition, that might change their entire life. You know, even if they place third, it might have a really big impact on them. And
right.
Actually, the student, the six-year-old, when she was practicing that much, was for a competition, like a practice competition I did. And right after that, she submitted this thing for the Parent Teacher Association. They have a competition, apparently, for songwriting. I had no idea. So she submitted a song she wrote to it, and she won the school, the city, and now she's on to states, and she'll probably win it because she's so young, you know, and then national is coming up, and she wrote a real song. And what do you think that's going to do to a kid when they realize that they're actually able to do something when they're seven, you know?
Even if they don't win, like, that can be motivating too, right? Like me, I'm kind of competitive. So if I did it and like, oh man, I didn't win, I bet I can next time, or whatever, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, well, we're getting close to the end of our time, but I wanted to also bring up this analogy of like having a trainer, right? And so when we're talking about like students sign up for lessons, they want to play piano, and then you're kind of like their trainer, where it's like, okay, well, that's what you want to do. I'm going to help you get to your goal. Now you need to do this, this, and this. In other words, like, trust me as your trainer or coach. Now we're going to do these, you know, things that, you know, you got to be able to play these scales and do these things.
Yeah. Well, what started that is a lot of people said, well, what about students that go at their own pace? And I push my students. I try to get them to do more than they think is possible. And I try to keep the lessons fast paced. And I have actually realized if a student stays in the same place too long, they get really discouraged. Mm-hmm. So yeah, even though it's more stressful, you know, one thing I tell my students, I'll say, if you're not doing, because most of my students are beginners, except for a few intermediate or more advanced students, but most of them are kind of beginners. And I say, if you're not doing at least like one song or two songs a week, depending on what book they're in, that's bad. That means you're not doing well. And I just give them I say, except for rare situations where you're struggling, on average, you should be, this is the pace you should be going. There is a truth that people work at their own pace, but I think we take that too far. So the reason I brought up the personal training thing is because, speaking of being out of shape from earlier, I'm in this group gym class, and they have like gym coaches that talk to you during the week and everything. And before I started, I asked him, I said, is any of this stuff true about weight loss or working out, that it's kind of based on genetics or, you know, based on these other factors? And he was like, almost never. No, it doesn't apply to you. Don't worry about it. You know, he just shot it down right away. And I think that's kind of true for piano students. I mean, I've taught a couple of students with special needs or, you know, situations like that where it's probably true. But for most kids, they can progress and excel. But if you say, well, they have to go at their own pace, which means they have to do one song a month, and the songs are for a beginner, so they're only four measures or a page long or, you know, whatever. That's a long time to work on one song, you know? And so my point is, at some point it comes down to eating right and doing the reps, or on piano, to respecting your instructor, listening, and your parent helping you at home, and just practice, you know, rather than just not listening and then saying, well, it's because I have different strengths than you.
All right. Well, I think we'll wrap it up there. This has been a great conversation. I'm sure we could go on about it more. Maybe we can do a follow-up.
Thank you for having me on, and yeah, I appreciate the conversation.
To the audience, remember there's always a video version of the podcast on YouTube, which is also The Piano Sensei Way. Check out thepianosenseiway.com. Make sure you subscribe. You can put your email in there and be notified of new episodes. Thanks everyone for listening. Until next time, take care.